Good evening and welcome once again to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. I'm the host of Your Legal Rights, Jeff Hayden. Joining me is tonight's co-host, San Mateo attorney David Nazzaro, practices criminal and family law, and has a master's degree in strategic intelligence and a master's degree in national security. In recent weeks, we focused more on legal nuts and bolts and the workings of things that directly affect us at home from day to day. Tonight, we take a look at national security, both law and policy, in light of recent events.
What are some of the ramifications of recent tensions with Russia or threats of terrorism, domestic extremism, election security, or even climate change? What of our own political polarization or that of the military? Will we look forward to a potential prosecution of Donald Trump? How do we balance human rights and civil liberties as we continue in a post-9/11 environment?
Give us a call at 415-841-4134. Again, 415-841-4134 if you're in the Bay Area. If you're outside the local dialing area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. And as always, our attorney guests cannot give you specific legal advice, as we don't have all the salient facts of your situation. We're happy to share the legal principles to help guide you in your decision-making, or maybe direct you where you could find some help. You can contact with any question tonight about national security law. You don't have to jump in at the point we may be in our conversation. To guide us through this examination of national security, John Michaels is professor of law at UCLA School of Law. His scholarly and teaching interests include constitutional law, administrative law, national security law, the separation of powers, presidential power, regulation, bureaucracy, and privatization. John clerked for Judge Guido Calabresi of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit, and then for Justice David Souter of the U.S. Supreme Court. Immediately prior to his appointment at UCLA, Professor Michaels worked as an associate in Arnold and Porter's National Security Law and Public Policy Group in Washington, D.C. A professor at law at Southwestern Law School, retired Lieutenant Colonel Rachel E. Van Landingham is a national security law and military justice expert and former judge advocate in the U.S. Air Force. Professor Van Landingham currently teaches criminal law, constitutional law, criminal procedure, and national security law. During Professor Van Landingham's military career, she served as a senior legal advisor on the international law of armed conflict, military prosecutor, criminal defense attorney, armed defense attorney, appellate defense attorney, and nuclear security inspector, and was stationed in the United States facilities in South Korea. I'm going to have to print this larger next time. And in Italy, with deployments to the Middle East. She was the legal advisor for international law at headquarters U.S. Central Command, where she advised on operational and international legal issues related to the armed conflicts in Afghanistan and Iraq, and has worked with members of Congress regarding legislative changes to military criminal law in the ongoing battle against sexual assault and harassment within the ranks. And with that, Professor Van Landingham, Professor Michaels, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Jeff, thanks so much for having us.
Thank you.
So to begin the conversation tonight, I'd like to talk about what roles each branch of the government plays. What role does the executive branch, the legislative branch, and the judiciary branch play in protecting the United States, the national security of the United States?
John, you want to take the first bite at the apple, and then I'll follow up?
Sure. Okay. So basically, the way that the federal government is constructed is power is divided among our three great branches, the executive branch headed by the president, the legislative branch, which is the House and the Senate, and the federal judiciary is the third branch. And it's a system of shared powers and some rivalry among the branches for exactly who has the lion's share of what power. And that plays out in national security a little differently than it plays out in domestic regulation. It plays out a little differently from law enforcement. And in the military context, or national security context, I'm sorry, I should say, it is generally understood that the president takes the lead. It's definitely the lead branch in that space. And oftentimes it's a case of Congress and the courts playing catch up if there's the political and institutional will to do so. And I think over time, the executive, led by the president, has taken the basically filled that gap where there's often some legislative hesitancy to step in, and certainly judicial hesitancy to step in to accrete more and more power to itself. And that's what we see often today, where really it is the president in the driver's seat of national security policy.
You know, John, I'll echo that and reinforce the idea that there is an intentional design to have friction amongst the branches, in particular the executive branch and the legislative branch. And that plays out in the national security arena as well. You'll see the branches butting heads, and they're supposed to sometimes, because that, you know, allegedly will produce better outcomes. I agree that there's been quite a bit of an accretion of national security powers by the executive branch that I don't think was envisioned by the founding fathers, but because of inertia, or, you know, if you don't vote on a bill, then you won't have a record to be voted to be considered by your constituents later. So there's sometimes some institutional incentive for Congress not to do anything. But Congress, I think, in the big picture, in the national security arena, does have at least the most power if it chose to use it, because it has the power to legislate. And perhaps even more importantly, that power to legislate and appropriate, to authorize funding, authorize programs and operations, and appropriate money to fund them. The president has to be able to pay for the things she or he does in the national security arena as well as everywhere else. And that money comes from Congress, and Congress can shut that money off. And we saw so much of that going on in the Vietnam era of trying to wind down the Vietnam War. And there were so many, as you know, rich cases that, well, the cases that were produced in trying to mediate between the executive branch and the legislative branch on who was going to get us out of Vietnam, how we were going to get out of Vietnam, who takes the reins. Specifically going back to the military, because you mentioned it, of course, national security law, it's huge, right? So what is it? What are we even talking about today? You know, folks often think of the military. There's so much more about national security law, than simply the military. It's, you know, what kind of program, what do we expect our government to do to keep us safe? Because first and foremost, we can't enjoy our civil liberties unless we, you know, we can safely walk our streets. We can safely get on airplanes. We can safely travel, et cetera. So national security law in particular deals with how each one of the branches, what is their role in helping keep us safe, from legislating programs to enforcing those programs by the executive branch, with a huge amount of discretion given to the executive branch. And then we have the clashes when you have the judicial branch step in, but not just the clashes, because there's quite a bit of legislation in which, and very interestingly, through both tort law, the ability of individuals to bring suit in our courts, quite a bit through such civil litigation, we see national security issues playing out. We see Congress wanting to give individuals the right to sue particular terrorist organizations, as well as state sponsors of terrorism, such as Iran, the chance to sue those groups in civil court to win. That's making a national security statement right there, to give individuals the right to sue a foreign nation, because typically there's something called sovereign immunity that protects foreign nations from being sued in U.S. court. So things can wind up in the judicial arena, not just because there's a clash between the executive branch and the legislative branch.
So it looks as in recent years, at least two of the branches of government have been working, co-opting, debasing, or straight out politicizing some of these institutions. And particularly, I'm looking at the military and Justice Departments, the State Department, and unfortunately, the intelligence units of our government How damaged do you think these departments really are, given the last several years? It doesn't seem to be just from one branch of government or one individual, but it seems that there's people from both parties in at least two of the three branches that have been really playing a tug of war with some of these things. And do you see a lot of damage that's been done? John, jump in.
I do. Please. Thank you. I do. And I think damage is the right word. I'm the first to critique the Trump administration for its basically explicit campaign from day one to what Steve Bannon called deconstruct the administrative state, which is basically the entire infrastructure of the federal government. And they pretty much committed to it and told us what they were going to do and did it. But I would underscore, and I think, Jeff, you were at least alluding to this, that there's been a longer campaign to attack bureaucracy, to attack the independence of career civil servants, and to question their loyalty, their expertise, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We see it not just in the context of politicizing the Justice Department officials who prosecuted folks like Michael Flynn, but we see it with Colonel Vindman, who testified about his observations and understandings about the now infamous Ukraine call, to even public health officials and trying to help steer us through this pandemic. So there has been years and years of challenge, and it kind of was brought to a head over the last 4 years with much insidious talk about a deep state, and that they're somehow the government workers are in tension with us as opposed to carrying out essentially the will of Congress, who gives them the authority to do what they do in the name of the United States. Already we had a little bit of a morale problem. We had a trust problem before we get to 2017. And all of that is simply leaned heavily on over the last 4 years. And we've seen much higher than average departures from all the agencies, from all of those agencies. Challenges with recruitment. Those who are brought in are there's been concerns that they're under-credentialed and perhaps overly politicized. And then on the way out, as the Trump administration was wrapping or not wrapping things up, as it were, installed some of the political leaders who are supposed to rotate out of office into career positions. So now we have a moment where the State Department's depleted, the Justice Department's depleted, many of the federal regulatory agencies are depleted. And it's going to be a real challenge to build them back up and to build them back up thoughtfully and carefully. I can tell you my students are much less enthusiastic about going into federal government than they were at any other time in my career. They're much more likely to look at working for, if they're committed to public service, to working for the state of California or for the city of Los Angeles, because they feel those are more stable workplaces where their expertise will be supported, as it were. So how do we build this back up is the kind of billion or trillion dollar question. And I think part of it, there's only so much that Joe Biden can do. There's only so much that this particular Congress can do in this moment, because if I'm someone who's thinking about a career in government, I'm also worried about what happens after Joe Biden or after we have the 2022 midterm elections and what's going to happen next. And so it really turns on how much this country is committed to a different trajectory from the one we've been on for some time, for people who are smart, thoughtful people who have a lot of different career options, how they're going to join in and embrace this project or find an alternative livelihood and an alternative mean to kind of ply their various crafts. So I think a lot of it turns on the public kind of re-embracing government if not a source of good, at least something that's not actively campaigning to undermine their lives, which is a lot of the rhetoric of the moment.
One of the things that I've seen politically, a generation ago, we were all hearing I don't want to politicize it by saying Republicans per se. It tended to be a more conservative stripe from that crossed party lines. But we saw an attack of a lower magnitude, but an attack on the attorneys, the courts. We heard a phrase activist judges bounced around. It seems like with the incoming of a populist president, that has shifted to the internal workings of the government, both legislative and particularly executive, and really trying to dismantle what we know as a lot of the federal government apparatus. And that really seems to play right into what you're saying.
Yeah, I think that's a really astute observation on that point, is that if you're generally of the school of thought that smaller government is better or lesser government is better, you would like government to be more limited. And the ways you could do that, if you can't do it purely through the will of the vote, is by compromising various government actors and government institutions so that they're no longer able to engage with the robustness that you fear. Okay. And at that time, and I think, Jeff, what you're referencing more is it's just, you know, aggressive regulation to fix our environmental problems, to remedy our history of various forms of demographic injustice, racial, gender, and other. And so it's not surprising that when the courts in particular took the lead in the civil rights movement, it took the lead in supporting a lot of the environmental initiatives that were new to the federal government in terms of endorsing them, that there was a backlash, and it was the let's get rid of the activist judges. And it worked because it disciplined progressives to appoint much more moderate, much more centrist judges who are not going to push the envelope. We didn't have a real successor to William Brennan on the Supreme Court or to Hugo Black or Douglas or any of those folks. We have justices who are center left justices, and I think that worked. And now the campaign is turning much more on the internal workings of bureaucracy and chilling the behavior of would be bureaucrats and having them go elsewhere for their careers or else maybe tack a different course from within.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM. I'm your host, Jeff Hayden. Tonight, we're taking a look at national security. If you have questions for my guests, our phone number is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the local dialing area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. As always, you may call regarding any question on tonight's topics of national security, or even just ask what all this means to your liberties and privacy. You're not limited to the point we may be in our conversation.
I'd like to ask a follow-up question to something you touched on briefly, and that is if you could give an evaluation of how big a security threat you believe right-wing political extremist groups are currently.
Well, I'll jump in on that one, and I'll just quote what was released today. There was a declassified threat assessment released by the new director of national intelligence, Avril Haines, who had been at the CIA, and she's now President Biden's director of national intelligence. It was an interagency report with the Counterterrorism Center, as well as the FBI and Department of Homeland Security, that puts the threat level at high for some kind of violence within the next year at the hands of right-wing extremists and militia groups. And that tracks an earlier report in January. But the report that was released today, the threat assessment, seems to ratchet it up a bit. So I don't have an opinion on what it is. I'm just reading the fact that our federal government, the experts in charge of determining that threat level, have placed it at a high threat level. You put that in context with what just happened last night. We had a brutal murder of 8 people in Atlanta, 6 of them Asian Americans, on the heels of an upsurge in racially motivated violence in this country and an upsurge in hate crimes that's been incurring and increasing over the last several years. That should put everyone on edge. that should put everyone on edge and give them pause to say, okay, what are we truly doing about this? What should we be doing about this? John?
Yeah, I think we've become a little bit inured to gun violence, or maybe just violence in general. And I think our threshold for, and I'm not commenting specifically, but I'm not also willing to per se exclude the tragic killings of last night. I just don't know enough yet. But the idea in which political disputes or political frustration is resolved by resorting to violence. I do worry about our kind of slow boil into tolerating a degree of violence, a degree of white supremacy, shows of strength of that sort, of intimidation of that sort. And it worries me. And, you know, when we think about security threats, it's not, you know, we think about previous instances. We think about other examples that we draw upon. And it's really hard to make direct comparisons because the examples are so different. But one can't help but think a little bit about the way the country came together, in some ways problematic, in other ways quite sensibly, after 9/11, to recognize problems. Now, there was all sorts of overreactions, all sorts of challenges associated with that. But there was at bottom a consensus that resorting to violence to settle political disputes was completely unacceptable.
I'd like to get your opinion, both of your opinions, on, with the rise of political frustration, political extremism, hate crimes, do either of you have an opinion on the nexus between social media, the internet, and this rise that we're seeing?
I think that's a great question. I'll jump in first, if you don't mind, John. I was going to mention that the rhetoric, because that ties back to what Jeff asked earlier, what he stated earlier regarding some of the rhetoric and messaging about the eroding of confidence in our civil bureaucracy, in our public servants, and that undermining of trust has been done through words. How are words transmitted today? How are messages and narratives transmitted today through social media? We don't have the control of major media corporations modulating everything that's getting out to the masses. Instead, we have a cacophony of voices, which on one hand is a good thing, right? We don't want what we're hearing to be controlled by just a few folks. But on the other hand, that means that there is no limit to what is going out, and it's magnified greatly. And then the silo effect of individuals being able to, through social media, being able to only be listening to and reading like-minded groups, and to not get through any kind of check on misinformation, any kind of check on, is what I'm being told accurate, or do I need to double check this somewhere? They're going to double check it in yet another echo chamber. It's not like those echo chambers and these groups didn't exist before, but social media and communications technology at an exponential rate has just exacerbated all of those pre-existing tendencies. And I have to throw on there and agree with what John said earlier about norms. So much of this isn't about law. I mean, here you have some law professors chatting and a lawyer as a moderator, one of the moderators as well. So much of it is, most major crimes in the United States, no one's ever caught or even prosecuted, right? Much of our systems today depend on our belief in them, our following of them because we want to, because we have faith that this is the best way. And so much of the way our country works is based on norms. And once these norms start to crumble, and when we have poor leadership, and not just at the White House, when we have poor leadership across the board in many, in local, state levels, as well as across the board in the different branches of government, and you have leaders that are willing to use social media improperly, to sow misinformation, to not challenge false narratives, to actually cast doubt on what is fact and what isn't, what is reality. We've got a problem. And how do we get back and reinforce those norms without without bringing back some of the old problems with pre-existing norms as well. That's a wonderful question. John, what do you think about the social media aspect of all this?
Okay, well, I think, first of all, Rachel, I think you captured everything. So I'm going to be really brief here. I thought it was a, you know, really helpful, really thoughtful answer. I'm going to go back to one other, you know, I'm going to harken back to history one more time here. And that in a different era where we had a different kind of framework for our consumption of information, the guardrails were tighter and narrower. So during Vietnam, which was referenced earlier, there were only so many sources of information without really having to go dig around hard, let alone quick information. You were watching one of the networks, you were reading your local paper and maybe one national paper. And so we're all kind of on the same page, more or less. Now, it's true, there were voices who were silent, there were voices who were marginalized as a result of that. Again, there's nothing, there's no perfect world, right? The post-war period was not a perfect world, let alone for everyone, right? But it was different, and we were used to that. And so there was constraints on the way in which people were able to talk to one another and leaders were able to communicate with us. And it strikes me that today all of that is pretty much gone because we can all find exactly the type of stories we want at the touch of a button. And we get into our bubbles and we reinforce our positions. And I'm guilty of it. And I assume other people who are listening recognize that they feel similar to that way as well. And it's challenging. Is there security and comfort with being around those who agree with you and who tell you and reinforce your inclination? And right now you can find out anything. And we need to kind of, again, look to each other and look to our leaders to, instead of pulling us further to the extremes, to talk about a way we can get on the same page. When Ron Paul was spewing a lot of his kind of wacky conspiracy, crazy hate messaging, he was doing it by fax machine. Do you imagine like how labor intensive that was to be doing that? There's only so many people who are like waiting for the Ron Paul fax. Right. And that, I mean, today you don't have to do that, right? Rand Paul tweets and we find out about it right away. And Rand Paul tweets and 80 million phones or whatever light up within an hour. And it's just, it's one generation, right?
John, going to that point about we all find comfort in like-minded individuals in our silos and in groups that are insulated from challenge. Part of that is, so how do we better instill critical thinking skills from, you know, from our children's age? You and I both have elementary school children. I mean, how do we get them to challenge what's in front of them, what's given to them, to say, you know, ask the why question and show me and prove me. You know, on the one hand, I don't want my 9-year-old challenging me all the time and asking why, but I don't want them believing everything that they read on the internet. I don't know what we need to do with that, except for better instilling critical thinking skills instead of teaching to the test in our elementary schools. But that gets a little far off the road of national security.
You know, one of the things that leaked out in the news today that was a little disturbing, it seems to have come from the interrogation of the suspect arrested in Atlanta. And if this is reliable reporting, and I can't say at this point whether that's going to prove to be reliable or not, he doesn't fancy himself as a racist. He doesn't see that this was done over race, but rather he considers himself a sex addict and was getting rid of these tempting places around him. And it really goes back to what you were saying, Rachel, a couple minutes ago about the effect of some of these words and some of the things that are put out there. It seems like he's moving from one idea that's being more actively challenged now to one that wasn't that long ago being very active and spewed about by some of the same people. You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM. We'll be back right after this.
This is Your Legal Rights here on local public radio, KALW in San Francisco. Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. And if you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. You can call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information. And stick around at 7 o'clock. We'll have Q from the CBC. Now back to Your Legal Rights.
Once again, you're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM. I'm your host, Jeff Hayden. Here with me today as co-host is David Nazara, where we are taking a look at national security. If you have questions for our guests, our phone number is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're not in the local area, if you're out of San Francisco, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. We'll pay the freight. Won't cost you a dime. 866-798-8255. As always, you can call regarding any question on tonight's topic. Tonight, we're talking national security. We have two distinguished experts on national security. You'll never have an opportunity like this to call us again on this topic, so give us a call. Even if just to ask what all this means to you, to your liberties today, to your privacy at home, you're not limited to the exact point we may be in our conversation. Again, our number 866-798-8255.
I'd like to ask about the current status of our civil liberties. There's been a lot of rhetoric, it seems, since 9/11 that our civil liberties are in a perpetual state of threat, that we're always under threat of our civil liberties being taken away. How would you evaluate the state of our civil liberties today, Rachel?
Thank you for that. It's a pretty broad question. So, you know, I would pick, you know, let's look at a couple of different civil liberties. We look at freedom of speech, but we can also look at freedom to peaceably assemble. And that second one, I'm concerned, because it seems like if you're, you know, far right, you know, white supremacist extremist, you know, bent on a violent uprising in Capitol Hill, you have the Department of Defense, at least the U.S. Army, you know, declining to provide the National Guard forces, who one of their missions is to help with law enforcement during civil unrest, sending them out in time to actually prevent some of the violence. Yet if you're individuals that are protesting racial violence in places like Portland last summer, you're going to have all sorts of federal law enforcement coming down on you. So I think, and you know, there were reports here where John and I both are in Los Angeles, that the Los Angeles formal police, that the police response to some of the Black Lives Matter marches and protests last summer resulted in serious abuses of civil liberties, and that were directly interfering with the American citizens' ability to peacefully assemble and make their thoughts known and their extreme displeasure with how with the extreme racial disparities and inequities that we have in this country following the murder of George Floyd. And so I think on that realm, that, you know, I'm not going to say it's healthy and, you know, an A+. I think I'd give it a C right now if I was grading. And then we can look at freedom of speech. We were just talking about, to link it into what we were speaking about before the break, it seems like social media technology, communications technology, has given everyone the most robust way to exercise their freedom of speech. I don't know how that's really going to play out. Because if everyone's shouting over each other, is anyone hearing each other? But what kind of chill effects are out there? But I'll go to John on the freedom of speech one.
So I want to telescope up a little bit on this, because I think we're in a really dangerous moment to have civil liberties discussions. Obviously, we need to have them, but I feel like we're in a time where we're constantly invoking rights for me, but not for thee. And we see this play out when people go into stores, private property, and demand that they be served, notwithstanding their complete resistance to store laws, like, hey, at Target or wherever, you need to wear a mask. as well as, you know, laws that are there to help private property owners protect their property. So we're seeing a real reversal in terms of rights discourse on that front. We're seeing that when discussions of cancel culture. So Josh Hawley is complaining or crying that he's been canceled because a private book publisher withdrew a book contract from him. Again, this is not a very small C conservative pro property rights way of thinking about the world, that you lose a TV spot or you lose a book deal and the government has somehow oppressed you. And then we're seeing it, especially we've seen it in California with religious institutions demanding that they be exempt from certain generally applicable laws, whether they're anti-discrimination laws or now public health laws, which gives them, in the case of public health, the right to operate even when most other institutions are closed down. And in discrimination context, where they don't want to, say, make a cake for a same-sex couple or whatever other potential customer kind of runs afoul of their personal moral code, as it were, or their religious code. So I think it's really hard to think about civil liberties and assessing kind of where we are on them, because in some ways we're doing quite well. In other ways, we've lost the vocabulary to have meaningful conversations about this, and it's all getting lumped together in ways that really seem to just be about culture wars. And that's before we get into the security stuff, where Rachel started us off. But I think there's a cultural component to even how we think about safety and security. Some people's security and safety is best guaranteed by being able to walk into a shopping mall with a rifle slung over your shoulder. And for other people, that's an absolutely terrifying prospect.
One of the things, as we're mentioning security and national security, it seems that we have learned as a group, as a people, to start thinking about such things as public health or climate change, migration, all as national security priorities, which seems to be something new. What are the benefits and problems of folding these all into the rubric of national security?
I can start. I asked a question of this sort, Jeff, to my class, I believe on Monday, and I got very different answers on whether yes or no. And what the threshold kind of the presumption that underlies this is that if things, and this kind of goes back to my very first answer to the first question posed, if you think that the executive has greater unilateral discretion over something that's defined as a national security interest, and you want something done on these particular sets of issues, then you might be more inclined to fold it in. So if you fear that Congress is sufficiently gridlocked or apathetic, or you think that the courts may, when they're evaluating a given initiative, may strike it down, but are less likely to strike down something that's cabined as national security, which is essentially how Trump's Muslim ban survived judicial scrutiny, is because he said it was a national security imperative. You may be tempted, particularly when things are as pressing as climate change and as pressing as the COVID crisis and as pressing, frankly, as the state of our immigration or lack of a coherent immigration strategy, to fold it in there. The downside is, what happens when the next guy or the next woman or the next person is in power and has now even more unilateral control over a greater swath of public policy and can do one of two things? Could reverse it all really much more easily than if Congress had legislated. And also, who knows what they could put, who knows what else would then be folded into the national rubric? Maybe religious freedom to discriminate could be considered a national security crisis. Certainly Trump labeled the migrants coming from Central America as a national security crisis because he wanted to mobilize the military to meet them in Texas. So anyway, that's the kind of trade-off. That's the pros and cons.
You know, the other side, I think, and this certainly befell President Trump, and it might on successors down the line, is as you label these things as national security, when there's some things that are beyond your control, you've really taken responsibility for it in a way that's going to hurt you as an executive. And by considering all these things security threats, they really became threats to his reelection in a way that perhaps they wouldn't have if he described things more in terms of world events and what's happening in the world right now, rather than taking them onto himself when he can't do anything about it. Not a strong political move, I don't think. But Rachel, I think you were going to speak, and I seem to have jumped in over you.
No, I was just going to wholeheartedly endorse everything that John just said, because there's a double-edged sword. Oftentimes, the executive will want to put the national security label on various issues and concerns and threats in order to try to maximize their range of action, because you see the greatest amount of discretionary decision-making authority with money given to the executive branch, given to the president, to do everything from use the National Guard in certain instances, to open up huge pots of money when it's, you know, determined by the executive that there's, you know, certain national security threats present. Yet, and you see, as I think John made the point earlier as well, when it's an issue regarding national security, that's when the courts typically, including the U.S. Supreme Court in particular, have typically showed the greatest amount of deference. Of course, we have the terrible and distasteful and shameful Korematsu case, when you have President Truman saying we have to round up Japanese Americans as well as Japanese citizens, but American citizens of Japanese descent, and put them in essentially concentration camps in the United States, because national security, without any individualized assessment of their individual threat level. Oh, it's national security. And our Supreme Court said, oh, that's fine. That's fine. Let it go. It's a war. We're scared. It's not fine. It was never fine. It was wrong then. It's wrong now. So we that boogeyman of its national security can be concerning because when it's abused. On the other hand, when I hear the Secretary of Defense accurately calling climate change, you know, the incredible extremes that we saw down in Houston, in which people died because of lack of appropriate infrastructure. It's like we were a third world country, not the United States. People died because of terrible planning on numerous different levels, terrible management to provide basic resources to individuals. And then when the climate, you know, when the Houston experienced that, those climate extremes, people died that didn't need to. So when I hear the Secretary of Defense calling climate change a national security threat, on one hand, I'm like, I'm good. It needs to be paid attention to. And if that's the way we're going to pay attention to it, maybe we really need to. And, you know, and he and the Department of Defense, of course, have eloquently articulated why it's a national security threat, from the massive refugee flows, and refugee flows always increase tensions and cause international problems that boomerang back and had directly implicate U.S. interests. The huge refugee flows, which will continue because they've already started because of the impact on various nations. And it winds up being poorer nations are more impacted by climate change because their crops aren't growing. They're experiencing extreme floods, et cetera. So in that sense, it's the good and the bad, right? Calling something a national security threat. There's good as long as we remember there can be bad, right? If there aren't the sufficient checks and balances regarding, okay, you called it a national security threat. That doesn't mean you can do anything you want with it, right? Let's figure out what we need to do.
You know, it is interesting when you juxtapose some of the examples you gave and look at where the people are coming from and how differently they're treated. There was a long time where the largest number of undocumented people were people from Great Britain who overstayed, and we never talked about them. When you looked at the Korematsu case in World War II, we of course found it necessary to intern people of Japanese descent because, after all, they looked differently from us. We didn't take similar actions against people of Germanic descent. But that's a whole different topic and a whole different show. Let me turn it over to Rufus from South City. Rufus, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Thank you for taking my call. I have a couple of questions here. Points, actually. I got to say, will you people talk about what makes law work? Is it only norms? Because I frankly don't see any reason why we won't. The United States isn't going to become like Russia and Mexico, strong men running things. people, the what's happening now is just people doing what people do. It's entirely normal, even expected. And I don't see anything changing. So what makes the law work and what makes it survive and what makes it popular and how can this be encouraged?
So I think that's a great question. I understand exactly where you're coming from with this. And I think we don't talk enough about norms and we talk too much about laws. Laws are brittle. Courts flinch when it's a tough case. Korematsu isn't a tough case per se, but the court did flinch there. And many other cases, they're really unwilling to say no to power often, especially if it's the president. Because they're worried about the downstream implications, not necessarily to themselves, but because they don't want to be blamed if the president takes an action, wants to take an action, they say no and something bad happens. Norms are what keeps things out of court. Norms are what diffuses tension before there's a conflict in the first place. There are, you know, I mentioned before about like the, you know, guardrails of information. There's also guardrails of professional conduct. And as long as we, you know, we can maybe push a little bit on the boundaries of what, where those are, and we expand them a little bit and we contract them a little bit. But as long as we stay within them, we don't have the crises that we have to run to the courts to resolve. When we break those norms or we've never had those norms in the first place, we get these really challenging moments. So we didn't have a norm about, for instance, about the unconstitutionality of segregation. We had bad precedents in place from way back when. And so they had to go to court. The courts did the right thing. For a while, they did the right thing, but it wasn't even fully accepted. To this day, it's not fully accepted. And again, it's because we don't have the, we have the laws on the books, we have the judges' opinions, but we don't have the sense in which we all can kind of recognize that there is things that are within bounds and out of bounds. And we didn't talk
about that. Well, I gotta ask, I'm sorry. What's going to happen when the guy, next guy comes in, who's a lot smarter than our last president, but basically it's the same agenda. I see no reason there isn't going to be another guy like him. There's a lot of people in this country that kind of feel totally right about walking on anybody they could deem as some other causing problems. So how did the law get going? I mean, what made it work? Is it, they got to have some self-interest to everybody? What makes laws, what makes it popular for people to listen to and obey laws? I don't see a lot of sunlight here, but I figure this is the point that should be talked about. Not the details, not the legal details. They're worth fighting over when you're in court, but that assumes you, you're going to get to court. So I'm sorry, I'm a little bit of a downer here, but
I'll bring you back to the point of, to me, it comes down to, there is something called the rule of law. The absence of the rule of law is anarchy. It's mass violence. It's what I saw on the streets of Kabul when I was there in 2009, 2010. You know, but at the end of the day, this country is an experiment. It remains an experiment. What's going to work? Part of it's that leap of faith. But there has to be, in any community, what makes... One of the things that makes America, the United States of America, so different and was so wonderful was that it was taking not some pre-existing tribe in Europe or anywhere else around the United States, these tribal cultures and identities that, you know, that had developed over, you know, centuries. It was saying, we are the melting pot. You come here, we're all going to have some shared commitment because we have shared values. So, and part of having a public education was not just because we wanted smart kids. It was because it was essential to inculcate, not indoctrinate, but inculcate children, you know, our children with shared values so that we can all work together because we all believe there has to be some things that we all believe in, or the majority of us believe in. We believe in certain freedoms, certain liberties. And we also believe in some of those liberties and freedoms being curtailed when it's necessary for the greater good, like having to wear a mask outside during a pandemic of global proportions that has, you know, a lethality rate. And just by simply wearing a mask, you can help save other people's lives. So there's a balance there, right? But I think it goes back to, you asked the question, you know, how is this all not just going to go to hell next with someone that's even, you know, has Trump's morality, but is a lot smarter? It's whether or not we as a country have a greater commitment to some shared values of our freedoms, of our liberties, of this American experiment. And I think the fact that the numbers that voted in this last election showed that, yes, there is a sizable minority that seems disenfranchised, that seems to think that everything that happened under the Trump administration was fine, including some of the gross abuses. But they are still a minority. And so now this is why you see such bitter fights going on regarding election law at every single level within our country, at the local state and federal level, to try to continue disenfranchising individuals, because folks fight the hardest when their backs up against the wall, right?
Yeah, that's clear. I guess I was thinking I was a little off topic, but maybe I'm not, because perhaps our national security is something that we need to look at home to be careful about.
And one of the things that struck me, Rufus, in your comments are just how inconsistent the courts are when it comes time to doing what the rest of us refer to as talking truth to power. They have tended, when you least expect it, to support institutions that are clearly unconstitutional or illegal, because that's where the power base is, and other times really surprise us by times that they come out and change existing law in order to support really a different set of values that are beginning to emerge.
I know what you're talking about, and I don't have any problem with that at all. I think that's fine. I'm concerned about the fact that assumes the courts have power, okay? That's what concerns me, where that power is going, how it's going to be enforced. It doesn't take many people to really screw the system up if they put their mind to it.
Well, Rufus, there's one thing I think we all agree on, is to a certain extent, whether it's the way the courts operate in enforcing criminal law, or the Congress in creating legislation, or the president enforcing the legislation and not doing its own, there's a certain amount of trust that's inherent. And if we lose that, if we're all coming in from different places and have a more chaotic experience, I think there's a real danger at some point that the experiment fails. Rufus, thank you for joining us in Your Legal Rights. I do appreciate the time you spent with us.
I appreciate your conversation. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
As we head into the home stretch, I'd like to hit a couple points real quickly. And one is, with the new administration, how successful do you think they're going to be with rebuilding confidence and trust with our most important allies abroad? John.
I think, if I'm an ally, or if I want to be an ally and feel a little bit uncertain about this, again, I'm not looking as much to Joe Biden as I'm looking to this kind of the same thing I was saying about government, would-be government workers. I want to know what's coming down the road, because Joe Biden's a pretty solid known commodity on the foreign affairs landscape. He hasn't taken many risks in terms of who he's surrounding himself with when it comes to his quite experienced foreign policy team, many of which are old Obama hands. So the leaders in the diplomatic corps in other countries pretty much know what they're getting from Joe Biden. And I think, again, it turns back, and this is why, you know, Rachel's last exchange with Rufus is, I think, quite revealing, was that it really turns back on, like, how committed we are to majoritarian democracy. And if we're committed to majoritarian democracy, we're likely going to have Joe Biden leaders for the foreseeable future. And that may mean we get someone who is right of center, but not, you know, way right of center, and we have the normal kind of back and forth with a country that's quite divided and quite evenly divided in many respects, alternates power, and we'd get a Mitt Romney, and then we would get, you know, maybe a Kamala Harris, and we'd go back and forth as we've historically done, and not really trouble the foreign allies that much. They've been pretty confident in that. But when we turn away from that project, and are willing to subvert democracy in order to make some kind of short-term cultural gain, or because I don't think it's I don't think the Trump regime is predicated. It might be his motivation, but it's predicated on corruption. It's predicated on a project of minority rights, of a certain type of minority rights. And once we signal to the rest of the world that we're not on board with that, I feel like they can have more comfort in a continuity of government across administrations and across congresses. So if I were the head, if I were the, you know, foreign leaders in the EU and Japan, I'd be saying, make sure you pass those democratic reforms, HR number one, not because they're political partisans themselves, but because they know that's the gateway to a more stable future for the most powerful and potentially dangerous presence on earth, which is the United States.
You know, one thought I had, I'd like you to spend about the last minute and a half or so that we have on this, is how might a Biden administration respond to the first terrorist attack that they suffer, whether it's an internal attack such as we saw on January 6th or as we saw in Oklahoma City, or whether it's an external one as President Bush saw shortly after taking office on 9/11. What do you think would be in store with the Trump administration, and what do you think the rest of our existence under him would look like?
You mean the Biden administration? I think you said Trump at the end.
Oh, perish the thought.
Yeah. So, I mean, as John Ackerley pointed out, you know, President Biden has surrounded himself with many old Obama era experienced hands. And I think that under the Biden administration, they would be looking at the lessons learned after 9/11 and the overreaction in things like the Patriot Act, the material witnesses for many Muslim Americans that were held, rounded up, and then never charged. I mean, it's a different context and a different day. There has been a further strengthening regarding our norms against torture and enhanced interrogation approaches. At least there's been a legal strengthening as well as reinforcement of the norms against it within the military itself. Some days I wonder how tenuous it would be if it was, you know, a radical, you know, Muslim extremist, attack, because I'm not sure how deep those reinforcements go. But I would hope that they would respond very carefully, looking at the lessons learned that we have. We have plenty of lessons learned on how to respond. And I think the way his new attorney general has been handling things very methodically, and seemingly consistently quickly in terms of criminal prosecutions, actually, but dealing with things regarding January 6th. But that brings me to, you know, being very careful about how do you handle something like prosecuting a former president, and the political ramifications of doing so, and really the long-term consequences of doing so.
And unfortunately, I think that's a conversation that we need to have off the show, and or maybe at a future show, but we are basically out of time. You've been listening to Your Legal Rights as we took a look at the current environment of national security law. Our guests tonight have been Professors John Michaels and Rachel Van Ludnigham. And tonight, my co-host has been David Nazzaro. Tonight's show was produced by David Nazzaro and yours truly. Please be sure to join Your Legal Rights again next week, Wednesday at 6 p.m., where we will take a look at the First Amendment and social media. Again, a big thanks to tonight's guests, and our thanks to all of you for listening. And at the controls, Damian D. Minor. I'm Jeff Hayden. Good night, and stay safe.